My name's Charlotte and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi Charlotte.
Did you say abstinence date? Yes. I've been abstinent since the 23rd of November. No, the 3rd. It's the 3rd of November. I've written that down wrong. The 3rd of November 2007. So, God willing, you know, I'm in my 11th year of abstinence. It'll be 11 years this year. And please bear with me this morning. I've got a cold, so I'm kind of half here. I'm abstinent today, and that's a miracle. That's an absolute miracle. It's just for today, and I'm abstinent. And I've been working this program since 2007. I've been in the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous since 2004, and I didn't get it straight away. I didn't want it straight away. I wasn't willing to go to any lengths for my recovery. And when I was working a program and had a sponsor, I was working through the steps, and I didn't like the relationship with God part, because I still wanted my will. I was happy to get some help around the food, but around my life. And step one is very clear, isn't it? We admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives were unmanageable. So I had to deal with the food first as an illness, and then deal with the fact that my life is unmanageable as a result of my food addiction. And I always used to think, well, it's because I feel a certain way, or this has happened, or that's happened, or she did this, or he did that. And I really thought it was my emotional disposition. Yes, all that is relevant, but the reason that I qualify for Overeaters Anonymous is step one and 12, what I'm powerless over and who I carry my message to. And I keep coming back because I have this fellowship and the people in it and my higher power have saved my life. And I wanted to read a bit that from the big book to start off, really to center where I'm going with this. And it says this is from the doctor's opinion, and I used the doctor's opinion with a sponsor, and the sponsor showed me how to work steps one and two through using this chapter and look at my eating history, look at how I binged, look at what I binged, and look at patterns within that so that I could work out what my allergies are. And I have a 3-meal-a-day food plan, and I eat all food groups, but my personal allergies, I can't, unfortunately, go near sugar and white flour for the reason that I'm about to read. It says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use food or alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I'm going to skip to the last paragraph, and it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by the alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few bites. So, without reading from the text now, that, you know, the few drinks is the few bites. You know, the chronic alcoholic is the chronic compulsive overeater, and this describes my illness. When I use food, I use it in a way that isn't just for pleasure. It's almost like a stimulant, a friend, a comfort. It was my everything, which sounds really silly, but it was private. When sugar, particularly for me, and I speak from my own experience, not OA as a whole, but when I started the first compulsive bite, I was very ritualistic. I used to gather food, you know, lay it out in front of me, and I used to binge it. I didn't want interruption. I usually liked the television on so that I could focus while I was binging, and then I would eat and eat and eat, and all the time I had hand to mouth, and it was that comforting feeling, and then it would rush to my head, and it was almost like a hit. And I am in, you know, well, I was really the paradox of step one, of being powerless over something, thinking you're in control of it, when actually it's in control of you, because it's in my mind and it's in the actual substance. So it's twofold, mental and physical. And I could not get that when I first came in here. I thought, look, I'm choosing to put this food in my mouth. It's my choice to binge. I'm choosing the food. I'm stealing the money to buy it. I'm all these crazy behaviours around food. And to actually accept, it says on page 18 of this book, you know, an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it an illness, you know, is like no other, you know, with, and it references it, you know, to cancer, people feeling sorry for them, but not with the compulsive overeater. And all I know is that in the darkness of this illness, over probably 2.5 decades of compulsive eating, I was alone. I felt so alone. I really did. And I came to my first meeting. I'd been into treatment, not for food, for substance misuse, which was as a result. I was a compulsive overeater who couldn't stop eating but desperately wanted to be thin. And the confusion of that, you know, I kept, my body obsession was horrific. You know, it was all about what I looked like, what people thought of me, what they were doing. I had no spiritual connection at all. And this relationship, when I came into OA for the first time, I went to a lot of meetings, I worked the program, and I kept binging on the way home from meetings. And I kept, you know, I just, that first compulsive bite, like the first drink, for, you know, for some reason, I just wasn't willing to pick up the phone, to call the sponsor when I wanted to binge, to pick up the leaflets. It was almost like the pain of growth and the pain of feeling was too much, and the pain, the uncomfortable, and it's almost like a sadistic pain of being in the food, because it is torturous, this illness. It says this is a life and death matter, and it is for me. You know, it's torturous being in the food, you know, being cut off, feeling dead behind the eyes. And I remember I'd been in recovery for about two or three years, and I got to a place in the food where I was paranoid, I was vomiting every day, and I met this sponsor, and you know, we talked, and first time I met somebody and I was willing to listen to them, and that was the key. I don't like listening. I like to do things my way. I think my thinking's right, and that's where the problem lies, and that's why the steps are the solution to this problem for me. And she showed me how to eat. She, you know, that was the primary thing to start off with. I didn't have a clue how to plan three meals, I didn't have any concept of a higher power, apart from the fact I didn't believe in this God that I hated, which was confusing in itself. And I remember she said, I'd like you to go into the kitchen and pray before you pick up any food and ask God to guide your hands. I only measure my carb, the rest of it I do as a third, third, third. And it's the first time in my life I actually went into a kitchen and I said, look, please help me to plate up a, you know, food, help me to weigh it, help me to follow through on what I've committed to this lady in this morning call. This woman, she turned up, you know, she was there every morning to take my call. And it was amazing. It, you know, it felt weird. It felt like I was taking my clothes off because I was, for the first time, I was getting so vulnerable around my food. I was being intimate and honest with another human being about the secrets that I had hidden for so long. And she helped me learn how to eat. She told me what a carb was. I didn't know what a carb, you know, I was very ignorant when I came in and I just didn't have a clue. And that's okay. That is really okay. I don't need to be perfect. And she showed me how to eat. I committed a food plan and then she weaned me and I started to do it with this higher power and asked the higher power how, you know, to help me with my food each day. It was practical. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't like a magical God told me what to do. It was a practical plan. But the difference for me between a diet sheet and a food plan in OA is that I'm involving my higher power in the process, and I'm not obsessing about calories, quantities, and that kind of thing. So I was able to then look at my eating history in step one. I was able to look at the binges. What did I eat? You know, what was the quantity like? How did it make me feel? What was the texture? You know, and I started to map out different foods that that had patterned ingredients that I was allergic to, and it was a very practical approach. And then once I had that in place, I moved on to step two, which is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was a bit skeptical about this, and I was reading through the big book, and I had deluded myself into thinking that my behaviour with food was okay, and it wasn't okay, because it was hurting me, and it was killing me, the way I was eating. It really was. And I could see that God, it says God could restore me to sanity. It wasn't God will. I have something to do in this. And my job is to show up. Okay, thank you. My job is to show up each day and to ask, you know, tell a higher power that I'm powerless over food and my life is unmanageable. Please help me. I can't do this. You know, and I've done that every day for 10 years and I'm still here by God's grace. I'm not dead, you know, through heart attack, through, you know, all sorts of, I can't think straight when I'm in a binge. You know, I really can't. I can't think, you know, my relationships break down. I want to isolate, you know, I like to hide. And being in a meeting, calling other people, it all challenges that sort of darkness and the shadow, really. It challenges it. So I started to come to believe, I'm still coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity because, and it's a cliche thing, but it's like the layers of an onion, you know, each year of recovery or each day of recovery, I learn something new and I realise, oh, that was a bit insane, you know, kind of, I don't have 2.5 decades of compulsive eating and expect to be restored in a year, that's, you know, done, you know, it's a lifetime, it's a life, you know, a life's work and it's just for today. All I have to, you know, be concerned with is getting from breakfast to lunch and from lunch to dinner without eating in between for me and head on the pillow abstinent. And that led me to step three where I, you know, I looked at the prayer in the big book about making a decision to hand my will and my life over to a higher power. And I needed to keep this step practical. What does that mean, handing my will and my life over? It's, you know, it was a bit vague to me, and will and my life is my thoughts and my actions, and it's a decision to go to do steps 4 through to 9. That's all it is a decision to do those steps and to follow those steps through and incorporate them into my life. And I did a step 4, and just to go back on step 3, because I have to remind myself of this every day, that it's the care of a higher power, you know, as I understand God. And I think that word care is really important. Am I going to take care of myself today? Am I going to ask God to help me take responsibility to almost parent myself today so that I'm abstinent? You know, boundaries for me with food and with life have given me freedom because I'm able to live within those boundaries because I don't know when to stop, and that's just not the food. It manifests itself. I'm compulsive around everything. You know, someone spoke about the washing machine head. You know, it goes round and round, and that's why this program is just so restorative. So I worked through step 4 using the big book columns, looking at my resentments, looking at the thoughts, the people, the feelings, the institutions that I have been angry. I had hundreds. You know, it was everything, everyone, and everything. For me was the problem, and clearly it's me, you know, the common denominator in all these situations is me. And I'm not negating things that happen to us because, you know, in recovery, I come with a lot of baggage and a lot of difficulties, challenges and heartaches. And I also process that through step 4. And, you know, it also says in the big book, you know, to not begrudge a psychiatrist, a doctor or a practitioner. If those things are needed for recovery, then fair enough, you know. But for me, the steps was restoring me to sanity. And I did process the step 4 and 5. And the wonderful thing about it is I wasn't stuck in it for like 2 years or 3 years. I did a column a week, you know, and pen down. And that way I could cope with what was coming up. I hadn't created something that was totally unmanageable where I was just gonna have a breakdown in it. And I did have a hard time working through the steps. A lot of stuff came up. It felt overwhelming. And you know, the most precious words that my sponsor gave to me was hold on, hold on. You know, and I had these things like trust the process, keep your eyes on your own plate and mind your own business. Cause I was like, well, she's doing this and she's doing that. And it was like, just focus. And I read in step 5 to God and to my sponsor, step 4. I went through each column, looking at my defects, looking at things that affected me, core issues. And I didn't like that defect bit. You know, the first time I came into program and I worked to step 6, that's actually where I picked up. When I worked it through in this period of abstinence, maintaining abstinence, you know, it's about humility. And, you know, it's kind of like a shuddery word, you know. And yet, actually, it's accepting myself as I am. You know, I am a compulsive overeater. That was one of my biggest resentments. I don't want to be a compulsive overeater. I don't want to have this illness. I don't want to be in OA. It's full of pride and ego. And, you know, God, as long as I'm honest about it, God can work with that, you know. And I saw these patterns, these defects. Fine, thank you. I saw these defects and I handed them over in my step 6 and 7. And it talks about humility and it talks about willingness in step 6 and 7. And I didn't know those words. I didn't have that, you know, the how of the program. Honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. And these were spiritual principles that the program have given me. And I endeavour to work them because I'm chronically impatient, you know, perfectionist, you know, and I work on these things daily. You know, every morning I get up and do step 1, 2, and 3, say my prayers, my 6, 7 prayers. And then I, after step 6 and 7, moved on to step 8, making amends for the harms that I had done. Some people I didn't do directly. Some people were possibilities, like maybes, because they couldn't be seen. Some people just had an honest letter or card in the post. And I got through it. Financial amends were included. That was painful, you know. And again, a day at a time, a meal at a time. And the sponsor supported me through this. Fellowship supported me through it. And then I, at 10, 11, and 12, I called the maintenance steps. And I worked 10 every day at the end of the day. And 10, step 10 is really 4 through to 9. Just reviewing my day, you know, with my higher power. I have to remember that each day because I'll review my day with me. Do I share my day with my higher power? You know, what happened? Were there any resentments? Have I stuck to my food plan? What was my food like? I still do a food review because it helps to look at my food. You know, if anything, if I put on weight in recovery or if I lose weight in recovery, you know, let's look at the food review and see where the honesty is, you know. And I was always taught that relapse doesn't happen just like that. It's a build-up over about 4 to 5 weeks, and it's when my honesty breaks down. And this program, is it says rigorous honesty, and that's like, ooh. And, you know, again, it says it's simple but not easy, but that's why we have a fellowship, because we don't do it alone. Because the steps are we admitted we were powerless, we came to believe, you know, we handed our will and our lives over to a higher power. And the OA pledge is about how we hold the hands, you know, we hold each other's hands. And again, I think about the preamble, it's our weakness, not our strength. We don't come in strutting like peacocks because we're broken. It's weakness that binds us together. And that's where step 11 came in, you know, building a relationship with a higher power, research. And it says the occasional hunch or inspiration usually, you know, becomes a working part of the mind, but I can still have these crazy ideas and totally think I'm linked to my higher power, and it's really Charlotte Power, you know, almighty Charlotte running the show. And it's usually when I feel hurt about something. It says we place ourselves in positions to be hurt. And I think, ouch, yes, I did that. I'm seeking myself. This is people-pleasing. You know, it's like, ouch, okay, thank you. Move on, stay abstinent, and carry the message, which is step 12. And that's why I've never left OA, because sponsorship, sponsoring, sponsees, it's giving back, isn't it? It's giving back. You know, there have been limitations with my health and so on. But again, there's always a way to give service. And sometimes showing up on the seat abstinent can be the best form of service. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing the story of the process.